Welcome to the latest edition of the Insurer's Best Policy Podcast. This issue marks a change of direction for our podcast. It is the first time we interview a retired industry leader. My guest today is Brian O'Hara, the founder of what became XL Capital, the insurer which, along with Ace, transformed Bermuda from the home of offshore captives to becoming a dominant market for specialty and reinsurance risks. Brian has just published a book, It's Not the Score, It's the Trip, which tracks his career beginning on the West Coast before moving eastwards to launch Tremec in the late 70s before XL in the mid 80s amidst the severe casualty crunch. In today's interview, we explore the growth of XL, the tensions with his chairman over XL's involvement with financial guarantee business, which imploded during the financial crisis, and what parallels Brian sees with the fundraising initiatives taking place now versus previous rounds on the island. But I begin by welcoming Brian to the Best Policy and ask him why, as he reveals in his book, he felt such an affinity with Bermuda as a young man, when at the time he hadn't even visited the island.
My father was a pretty amazing guy. He always graduated at the top of his class at the top schools, and then he got into a naval officer candidate program at Harvard Business School, where you got your Navy lieutenant and MBA at the same time. An intense year-long program. There were 77 in his class, and he tied at the top of the class with another guy. 75 of them were given orders to go to the South Pacific, and he got to flip a coin with the other guy he was tied with. The loser of the coin flip was assigned to the European theater, and the winner was assigned to Bermuda. And he had a logistics MBA degree, and he went to Bermuda to become the chief logistics officer at the new naval base. And my sister, Trish, was born here at the end of the war, which actually made her Bermudian. And my two older brothers were young here, too. Anyway, I grew up hearing about this beautiful place. It seemed magical as I was growing up in urban Philadelphia, which was anything but paradisical. So, you know, the contrast in my head, it just really took seed, and it was just in there big. And then in 1977, working at General Re on the 49th floor of the brand new Bank of America building with spectacular views of Golden Gate Bridge and Marin, you know, we were all in our 20s. We were having the best time. But I read this article about Leslie Dew leaving leadership at Lloyd's to join INSCO, Gulf Whales Captive in Bermuda. And I had the biggest aha moment in my life. I just said, that's it. Bermuda is the future. I got to get there. I came home that night and I said to my wife, Nancy, I don't know how, I don't know when, but we're going to Bermuda. She said, great. And so I started networking at General Re. I got moved to the brand new captive underwriting department in the home office in Greenwich. And then started proselytizing four guys I really thought would like my idea of forming a company in Bermuda to be close to the captives and on the ground floor. And we all agreed, and we raised $25 million in 1979 to form the first independent reinsurer in Bermuda. So it was a quiet place. I mean, there wasn't a lot of infrastructure. A colleague of mine in General Re San Francisco got transferred to Hartford, and I said, what's it like? And he said, a cemetery with lights. And Bermuda actually is a cemetery, but we didn't have any lights. I mean, at night, there was nothing. It was really quiet. We didn't have live TV. It was very primitive, but beautiful. It had all the ingredients for casualty insurance and reinsurance, with the no income tax on the corporate earnings, and really good regulatory environment.
Well, perhaps just very quickly, you talk about raising $25 million, which wouldn't, of course, get a company very far these days. But I imagine was a challenge, wasn't it? I mean, not least.
Oh, it was.
Proposing something new.
It was very difficult. Conning and Company was our backer and banker, and we worked our butt off to try to convince investors, and, you know, as we were running out of money, we were able to close on the $25 million investment, which was real scary, but what a great outcome.
And so there you were in Bermuda, early 80s with Trenwick. And talk us through the next stages. Of course, XL was mid 80s, and it'd be great to hear about that in a moment. But what was the next few years, Brian, with you in the early 80s in Bermuda?
Well, the early 80s were pretty good. The market was pretty hard going into 79, 80, but around that time, Fred Rice, who started the captive movement in Bermuda, had an attorney named Sidney Pine, and he brought some lawsuits against the IRS. The IRS said that captives couldn't deduct their premium because it was all internal. The risk, there wasn't any transfer of risk. They were insuring their own risk. So long story short, he got the IRS to agree that if a captive wrote more than 30% of their business with non-related parties, they could deduct all of their premium. Now, this created a huge wave of captives getting into the third-party underwriting business. And they gave their underwriting pen to brokers in London and brought them to Bermuda, and they created the softest market of all time. I mean, the deals were so bad and stupid, it just couldn't write anything. And then these captives started blowing up and going out of business because they were just taking horribly large risks for nothing. And it was like giving blank checks away. So in 1984, it was so bad, we had to leave because you couldn't do business in Bermuda. It was a very disappointing time in life for Nancy and me, and we moved back to home in Connecticut, where we fortunately had kept a home. And so Trenwick was a Connecticut reinsurer, but because we played it pretty well in that soft market and didn't burn ourselves up, we were able to do an IPO in June of 1986 and raise $100 million. In the middle of the IPO, Bob Newhouse, who's chairman of Marsh McLennan, whose office right across the street from Morgan Stanley, where we were doing the IPO, came in and burst in the middle of our meeting and said, "We've decided you're going to be our underwriter for what we call a Project XL." And I said, "Bob, do we have a choice in that?" Basically, no. And they were Marsh McLennan. And so we agreed to do it. And so we led all the underwriting of these Fortune 500 customers of Marsh McLennan, where you couldn't find any commercial insurance above $25 million. But we were writing, the deal was the companies we were underwriting, if they accepted our underwriting, they had to put up the capital, at least 100% of the premium, or in high risk, 200% of the premium. A long story short, they got to 60 Fortune 500 companies that agreed to do it, and it raised $440 million. And then Bob Clements and Bob Newhouse approached me to leave Trenwick to become the president and chief operating and underwriting officer of XL. And I agreed. And in the fall of 1986, I moved to Bermuda, and we opened up first office, two hotel rooms in St. Helene Hotel.
And well, and as I said, the rest is history, but we'll actually explore that a bit more in one moment. But actually, it'd be very interesting to get your reflections on Bob Clements, who you referenced there. But of course, he played such a pivotal role in shaping the industry as well. And of course, Bermuda, obviously, he's no longer with us. It'd be very interesting to hear your observations of the man.
Well, I loved him. What he did for my career is indescribable. And of course, it meant for the rest of my career, anything he asked for, I had to say yes, no matter whether I liked it or not. Yeah. And most of the time, though, yes was the right answer. Not 100%, yeah. But it was a good batting average. And he and his wife and Nancy and I, we used to play tennis together all the time. So we became really good friends on top of it all. And he was magic. And it was a sad, sad day that he died before his time. And yeah. His funeral service at the Waldorf Astoria was really an amazing event.
Yeah, no, a great testimony to him. Perhaps when XL was established mid-80s in conjunction with MMC, as you say, but did you have any idea quite how the company was going to evolve over the next 20 years? I mean, I got a vision. I'm sure you had a sense of scale.
No idea. Nobody did. It was just one foot in front of the other, one day at a time. Everything we were doing was pretty experimental. We're taking these huge net lines, no reinsurance, with the largest risks in the world. Yeah. Nobody knew it was going to work out, let alone build this big industry. The jury was out for a number of years. And the growth of the Bermuda market was iterative. By the early 90s, we were starting to be comfortable that we were doing the right thing. We were making a lot of money, as a matter of fact. And you also can make a lot of money in investments. And then just when we had really taken almost all Fortune 500 customers, we're finding little growth in our core casualty line. We thought, well, maybe this property and Piper Alpha happened that really hit the Lloyd's market. And we could see it was going to cause somewhat of a capacity crunch. And Mike Keaveney and I, he was my CEO at the time, we decided that it might be a good thing to maybe get into the property cat business. And just at that time, Bob Clements and Bob Newhouse came to us and said, we have an idea for this new property cat company, Mid-Ocean Re. So we were ready, and we put up $30 million of the $100 million startup capital. And within a year after the big cat in Andrew in Florida, we went public and went up to $1 billion, and we kept our 30% share at $300 million. And then RenRe was a fast follower, and there several others. So it was iterative. 92, you had the property cat series of companies. And then in 2001, after 9/11, you had Axis, RH, Allied World, and a number of others. And then in 2006, after KRW et al., we had another series of startups. So it's been iterative. And no, we certainly didn't have any idea it would grow to what it became.
Well, as you say, Brian, I mean, as XL was conceived in a hard market, and Bermuda's been at the heart of a number of those classes as you track ever since. We're now arguably in a fresh hard market. Certainly that's the view of Kevin O'Donnell. And we are seeing fundraising initiatives. And I'd be very interested to get your comparative sense as to where this current market is and what you think may be happening with the capital raising compared to some of those previous hard market activities.
It's interesting to see so far that current players like RenRe and Arch and a few others are attracting scale-up capital. And I know RenRe's had a long-term good relationship with State Farm, and they provided more capital. So it's putting those companies in good shape to take advantage of a very hardening market. And there's so many forces at work, it's hard to see exactly where it's going to go. What's very interesting is Stephen Catlin, Convex, was over about a year and a half ago when they started. I said to myself, oh, that's what we need in the industry, more capital. You know, I didn't think there were any opportunities. You know, the market looked like it was going to stay lousy forever. But apparently he's not an accident. He must be very prescient, because he is really in a great position right now.
Yeah. That's very true. And of course, Stephen chose Bermuda. And I was going to ask, as someone that's such a keen advocate of the islands and been such a big supporter of the island's industry base, is the sort of Bermuda mousetrap, as it was once called, is it still as attractive for startups as it was? I mean, if you look at some of the headwinds and sort of global regulation, tax scrutiny, consolidation, etc., I just wonder whether Bermuda is still such an attractive place as it clearly once was.
I don't see why not. We have built up world-class regulator in the Bermuda Monetary Authority, and it's recognized by the NAIC as such, and even by the EU, many of whom in the EU would like to see Bermuda sink to the bottom of the ocean, but they just can't build any kind of case that we don't have absolute top-notch regulation and we're not a threat to anybody in the industry. And, you know, there's the creativity continues. ILS was creative. and forms of that will continue, and different types of sidecar vehicles. I think that will be very popular in bringing capital to take advantage of teaming up with current players that are still vibrant in the industry. And no, I think that we have good relationship with both US and EU, and this is the fastest, easiest place to start up with large capital.
Anecdotally, Bermuda appears to be as welcoming a kind of huge surge of business flow following the kind of retrenchment in some areas of the domestic US market. And arguably, that creates different challenges, around resources, talent shortages. Of course, we've got COVID-19, which, of course, is restricting movement of professionals for obvious reasons. I mean, is that a kind of short-term issue for Bermuda, do you think? Has it got the sufficient talent on the island to be able to, and resources to cope with the additional demand?
I believe so. I know everybody has been working from home, but I've been talking to friends that I'm finally able to see, because we did a total lockdown. We did a real shutdown here a couple months ago. You only could leave your home to go to the market, and only on certain days of the week with your name, beginning of your name. So it worked. We have two cases, one in the hospital and one isn't. We had up to 140 cases, mostly emanating from people who had flown in from the US. And once we shut that down, it got up to 140, and it's been on a steady decline. And it looks to me like it's dead. Now, we have to open up, and our flights are just starting. The first flight came in yesterday from Toronto. But I mean, it's not easy coming in here. You got to get tested before you come, when you come, and quarantine until you get the result of the test back. Gradually we can hopefully build out. So I think we are able to continue to do business full bore online. Our business is particularly well suited for online. And now with it opening up, I don't see why we can't have another round of great success.
Well, fine. Actually, I'll just return to Excel, if I your career at Excel, if I may. And because in the book you talk about the challenges of running a public company, given the responsibility and the scope of accountability that sits with being a CEO. And so my question to you is, what, bearing that in mind, what was your most challenging time? And indeed, if you could go back, would you have done anything differently?
Well, the most challenging time was after KRW, Katrina, Rita, Wilma, and billion-dollar losses we took, and then losing the Winitzer Reserve arbitration. Right on the heels of that, it was a big 1-2 punch that caused the rating agencies to put us on downgrade watch and all of that. And basically, it wasn't a decision. It was something I just had to do, which was I had to raise $3 billion. So Goldman Sachs was our main banker. And I said, how do we raise $3 billion? He said, well, we can set up 40 meetings over 2.5 days, and you have to sell 39 of them. And, it wasn't a choice or decision. It's just something I had to do. And we did it. Yarny is the one guy, and I knew him. He had been an investor at Excel. And I said, why didn't you invest? He said, I don't like the financial guarantee business. I thought to myself, me neither. And but I couldn't tell them that. I wanted to, but I was under orders that I had to pretend I loved the financial guarantee business.
Well, perhaps, I mean, that leads me on, I guess. I mean, it's 12 years or so since the financial crisis, and as you alluded to, that was a time of particular difficulty for Excel because of that reason you just explained. What were your thoughts at the time, and more generally, have the lessons been learned from 12 years ago?
Oh, I definitely believe so. I think people are really good at governance. I think boards try to choose good CEOs and managers and let them do the job and not get in their way and have a unified strategy and stick to the strategy. So I think there haven't been big self-inflicted wounds here by and large. Most of the problems that are coming on are external, the liability situation with the liberal courts. And now you have riot and civil commotion and the pandemic. And the pandemic is the big, big question mark.
And we'll talk about that in one moment, but just to perhaps focus on that time after the fundraising, And of course, you, as the book outlines, you face some challenges in the boardroom, not least the former chairman, Mike Esposito, and some of his activities. What drove this wedge between you and him? And did this make, at the time, make your job all the more difficult in terms of, you know, running Excel?
Well, Mike Esposito came from banking. He was the chief financial officer at Chase Bank under Rockefeller. You know, he was an impressive financial guy and enjoyed a big reputation in the financial markets. And he didn't like the volatility of our insurance and reinsurance business. But that's what it's all about. You really, to succeed, you have to embrace volatility and convince investors that it's their friend, because it's a business where when you have a big loss, you can get it back within some in the near future. And that's what happens and what we do. But he didn't like it. And he wanted to move more and more into banking type related businesses like financial guarantee. But we ended up with a fractured strategy, as one of our directors called it in time. And he was right. It led to a duality of management. It wasn't clear who was in charge. Other than if anything went wrong, I usually got the blame.
Gotcha. Okay. Brian, you mentioned a moment ago some of the issues facing the industry now, and the strikes and the riots, the civil unrest, and perhaps an even bigger shadow in terms of COVID-19. And is COVID-19 and I guess other potential future pandemics, how much of a concern for the industry is this? Is it even an opportunity? I don't know. I mean, what's your thoughts?
It's the huge elephant in the room. There are more and more growing class action suits trying to get business interruption coverage, where we know it's excluded. Regulators, I'm glad to see, are coming out to say that. I've been on the board of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce for 20 years and involved with their Institute for Legal Reform. And the Chamber is working with Congress to try to make sure that this doesn't happen. But if in California you got a big award, it would be eventually approved by the state Supreme Court, and it mandated all insurers to cover business interruption, it could bankrupt the industry. The numbers in California are massive. And there are other states doing it as well. And there are some jurisdictions like Louisiana, which are pretty liberal, and that there's a big class action there. So I don't know, it remains to be seen. It's going to be a big overhang on the industry, which is going to continue to make it a very hard market, because what is known is terrible, and the unknown is even worse.
And actually, we speak, Brian, the day after, I think, the state legislature in California, I think, have introduced a proposed bill, which, you know, in effect would have the impact of sort of potentially sort of retrospectively creating liabilities to the industry. I mean, that's, I guess you would argue that's just evidence of your views on the state.
I don't think it's going to go away over anytime soon.
Your former company, Excel, is now a very different entity in the sense that it's a subsidiary of Europe's largest insurer. And that was, of course, a groundbreaking transaction in 2018. I'm very interested to know, you know, what did you think at the time you heard about the proposed transaction? And, you know, 2 years on, are you concerned that Excel will lose its entrepreneurial zeal, its approach of embracing volatility? Do you think that's in danger of being lost because of its new owner?
Well, first, it was quite a shock, because they had kept it pretty good secret. I didn't know those talks were going on. And just being so personally involved with the company for most of my life, that it was strange. But as I examined it, it made a lot of sense. The fit is very, very good in terms of geography and lines of business. AXA had nothing in the United States to count, and they're huge in Asia and parts of Europe, South America, where Excel had involvement but weren't that big. And so the combination is great from that standpoint. And while it's no longer of a size to be more nimble, the combined sides have the resources that are huge and ample that can allow them to be a leader in things like AI. And I know that they're doing a lot of research in that area and on climate and a bunch of areas that I think are going to be big. So now it's going to be bumpy when you're putting two cultures together. I've learned that along the way, especially something as huge as AXA. But I think they should come through it well and be of great interest watching.
Recently, Brian, you decided to join a much smaller organization, Envelope Risk. I mean, this is obviously a cyber-focused modeling company with sort of MGA underwriting component to it as well. What attracted you to the business, and what made it stand out?
Well, Peter, first of all, I promised myself in my retirement that I would only get involved with things that I thought were truly new and different and potential game changers. I had no interest in joining a public company board at all, no matter what they paid, or anything that was business as usual. And I turned down a lot of those from friends, but I'm so glad I stuck with that principle. And the chief underwriter at Envelope is a guy named Ari Chatterjee, who I had the pleasure of working on an earlier project on intangible asset insurance that I looked like it could be a big winner. And I worked with Ari and Michael Halloran at Aon and Tom Donahue Jr., who I met through the chamber. And we did a lot of work, and Ari is very, very smart actuarial underwriter, one of the best I've ever met, and he did a lot of great work for that project, although the bank regulators at the end of the day turned it down. Very disappointing. But Ari told me about Envelope and he's joining, and he said, did I want to meet their CEO, Jonathan Spry, and CIO Paul Guthrie at a lunch in Bermuda. They're visiting from London. And we had lunch, we hit it off, and I just really was enamored of the AI approach they were taking to cyber risk. And now we can expand it to a number of lines of business. The quantitative talent at Envelope is truly impressed and exciting. So I'm really glad I made that decision, and I'm looking forward to some really neat developments down the road.
Thanks, Brian. I'm guessing you, just from those comments, that you see AI as integral to the future of underwriting. Is that correct?
I think it's going to be huge. You probably saw Lemonade went public yesterday and doubled in price. That was kind of crazy. That actually evocative of the late 90s dot-com boom when companies were valued on revenue, not profit. And that's kind of the same thing with Lemonade because their model is very brilliant, robot-driven, but it's a very small target market. And I'm just not sure that their approach is scalable. So if I had doubled my money in that IPO, I'd be looking for the exit. But on the other hand, I think, and I'd like to think Envelope might be one of the winners where the Lemonade is basically a pure machine-driven approach. And in underwriting, I still think you have to have an underwriter because life is full of nuance and unaccountable forces that can't be quantified. But the combination of a really smart machine and a really smart underwriter like Ari is a very formidable competitive advantage in the marketplace.
Thank you, Brian. We've just got time for, I think, just a couple more questions. And there's one, again, in your book, we track a lot of the achievements you've made in a very successful career. The question I'd like to ask is perhaps what is the one that you're most proud of when you look back over your career? What is the one that stands out for you?
I have a pretty good idea. That was in 2004. There was a bid rigging scandal going on in the industry, and everybody was being investigated, and we were. And then I found out, I didn't even know about the bid rigging, but our top underwriters, Clive Tobin and Keith Fisher, were Marsh McLennan tried to make them play into the bid rigging, and they refused to do it flat out. And it cost us business, but boy, it really was a fantastic thing that I give tribute to our culture that we would never, even if we lost half the business from Marsh, consider cooperating with something like that. And we had a nascent organization called ABIR, Association of Bermuda Insurance and Reinsurance, and a number of the players, companies that were part of that were caught up in the scandal of the bid rigging, and we were one of the few that weren't. And by acclamation, they all voted to make me the first chairman of ABIR. And I was very proud of that. And And I'm proud that one of the first things we did with the revised ABEER is increase the amount of funding we put into it and direct it to the Bermuda Monetary Authority to build up the capabilities and make that a world-class organization, which it became over time. So that I was very proud of that.
And actually, who were your inspirational leaders as a young man in the industry, Brian? And perhaps a corollary to that, who do you think are the inspirational leaders in the industry now?
I have prejudices, of course. But in growing up at General Re, we had a tremendous leader and facultative called Bill Clark, who I learned he gave us all kinds of entrepreneurial room and tools, and it worked tremendously. And in fact, over the next 10, 15 years, it were a whole lot of us who worked at General Re came out and became leaders in new companies forming in the industry. I mean, he was really a genius. And part of the underwriting culture there was Robin Jackson, who was at General Re, and then he went back to Lloyd's and he ran the Merit Syndicate, one of the biggest, best in casualty. So they were early heroes of mine. And along the way, I've enjoyed to get to know Hank Greenberg, which is a challenging thing, but the guy is, I mean, he's 95 and he's still going. Yeah. And his life story is just phenomenal. He's one of the most able, brilliant people I've ever met, without a doubt. And Pat Ryan is up there too. He's a huge favorite of mine. And you look at what he's done and accomplished, and he's still doing it. You know, he's in his 80s and he's acting like he needs the next paycheck to pay his rent. and of course, you have friends of mine, Brian Dupreau and Stephen Catlin, who are terrific leaders, and I've shown that. Greg Hendrick, it'll be interesting to see where he might end up. But a whole lot of the people I grew up in management are all retired now. And so I don't have the pleasure of knowing a lot of the current leaders, but those people are a top list. And there's Mike McGavick, who I don't know if he wants to come back to insurance, but I've urged him to become president of the United States. I think he would do a fantastic job.
Well, we'll wait to see on Mike. Ryan, thank you. Now, when I read your book, I knew a fair amount about you beforehand. I knew a fair amount about Excel beforehand. But I had no idea that you were such a big Grateful Dead fan, and that comes out in quite a few different chapters. So my final question to you is, of all of the Grateful Dead tracks, which is the one that you most closely identify with and why? What is your favorite Grateful Dead song?
Well, that's a no-doubter, Ripple, which Nancy's sister at our wedding read the lyrics of Ripple as if it was a psalm from the Bible. And it really made an impression on me. And watching Jerry Garcia perform it, you know, it's just something kind of otherworldly, the way he did it. It just seemed to be such a great metaphor for life. And then I had this incredible experience about 6 years ago at the Bohemian Grove, which I've been a fortunate guest for many times. And at night, wandering through the redwood forest in the total dark, there are 95 camps there. And I had heard one of the camps was called Rattlers, and Bob Weir was the head of it. But that he was rarely there because he was out in the summer on tour. Anyway, that one night, I heard this music, and it sounded familiar, and I followed it, and I looked around a corner, and there was Bob Weir and four musicians sitting around a campfire, and there was a seat next to Bob, empty. And I walked in, and I sat down, and they were just starting to play Ripple, and I took over the lead.
It was clearly meant to be.
and when the song ended, Bob and they all looked at me like, "Who are you?" And I said, "That was my wedding song 40 years ago." And they went, "Cool. Can I give you a tour of the camp?" I said, "Sure."
That brings to an end our interview with Brian O'Hara. His book, It's Not the Score, It's the Trip, is available both in print and in e-version from Amazon and other stores. Brian, thank you very much for your time today. And look out for the next Best Policy podcast interview later this week, which is with QBE boss Pat Regan. Thank you very much.